Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Aaron Liddell. He's an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast.
Always a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for thinking about me and having me. And I look forward to rambling again for about an hour.
No, man. Love talking to you. You have tons of great information on many, many aspects of oral surgery. I've gotten a lot of great feedback from listeners. And so I appreciate you sharing your information here. Before we get started, a couple quick announcements. One is I was recently made aware of this app called Speechify. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's a pretty cool app that uses AI. And basically, you can drop in any PDF, if you have a textbook, an article, anything, and it will use AI and make it an audible book, basically, and just read it to you. And you can actually record your own voice, and it will use your voice to read the book. You can use Snoop Dogg's voice, like all these different voices. So I'm a big Audible junkie and listening to books while I drive and podcasts. So for all those out there who want to do that, check it out. Also, too, if you let me know, shoot me a text or something, I have a link where you can get $60 off, because I think it's like $140 for a year for this app, and it's $60 off if I send you this link. Anyway, so just throwing that in there. Myself and my brother use it a lot for listening to textbooks and articles and stuff like that. So yeah, Aaron, we're glad to have you. You were mentioning before we jumped on here that you were in a recent biking accident. That's another thing to make our guests aware of. Don't be biking when there's deers around or it's dark. Well, what else do you want to say about that, Aaron?
Yeah, I mean, I was hunting without a license. Yeah, I smacked a deer at fairly high speeds, like kind of mid 40 miles an hour-ish on my road bike about 2 months ago, and ended up in the ICU and have been now a chest trauma patient. Wouldn't recommend it, but if you're going to do it, you know, you might as well do it right. Hit the deer hard, kill the deer, and then end up in the unit. And, you know, it's a lose-lose for everybody.
Just to march your back.
Glad to be alive.
Yes. Yes, I'm glad you're alive too. On that note of trauma, you know, maybe we want to talk today a little bit about ZMC fractures. Yeah, can you kick us off and just start talking to us a little bit about these types of fractures, how they occur, how you diagnose, stuff like that?
Yeah, like we were talking about, this may go down as the most boring podcast that you've ever moderated. My hopes are that it's the most listened to podcast on Spotify. I kind of looked at Rogan's lineup. They look like they're kind of duddy. I think we're going to take it this week. So
yes, sir.
Hold on tight here. Anybody that does facial trauma with any kind of volume, you're going to come across ZMC, ZMOC, whatever you want to call them, fractures. Historically, we refer to them as zygomaticomaxillary complex fractures. But when you really look at the anatomy of the lateral midface, these fractures almost always propagate through the orbital floor, along the inferior fissure. And so really, they really should probably be looked at as orbitozygomatic complex or orbitozygomatic fractures. Very, very high prevalence. I mean, you know, I think about our trauma group, and we've talked about this during other interviews and other discussions. We cover really 7 facilities. So our volume's fairly high, especially in the summer. And it's probably one of the more common calls that we get is the orbitozygomatic fracture. And so, you know, when you look at this, I think it's important to sort of generate just an algorithm of how we're going to look at these. What's the timing in terms of management? What's the primary triage look like? And then, you know, surgery approaches and sort of the way that we rationalize and think about how we're going to go in and address these things. let's look at, you know, well, I'm going to give you the private practice epidemiology here and just say they're pretty common fractures as opposed to giving you a percentage. Usually left side, if you think about the incidence, this is usually, if you look at the data, it's men in their third and fourth decades that tend to sort of be the major players in these fractures, although we can see them in other graphics. Usually it's the left side from a right hook, although, you know, we see a lot of falls, a lot of motor vehicle collisions, bike crashes, et cetera. And so, you know, if you kind of bump into it, I spent a lot of time when I first came to Denver educating ER physicians on what probably generated the need for a consult call in the middle of the night and what didn't probably need a consult call. And so, you know, for the residents that are listening to this, there's probably a lot of value gleaned in your primary assessment of these patients. For those of us that are in the private sector, most of the time I don't get called on these overnight. And in fact, a lot of times I don't get called on them at all. They just sort of show up in my clinic. They're triaged by the ER doctors and then sent off to my clinic. But let's go back and say that we're a resident and the patients come into the ED, the ER has done a primary survey, and then the secondary survey, we're going to start looking at these. So what are we going to see on a clinical examination in sort of somebody with a ZMC or an orbital ZMC fracture? Well, obviously periorbital edema initially, ecchymosis probably not because it's a, you know, an acute onset thing. So our standard examination is the same for everything. I usually start top to bottom. So I'm looking at the frontal region, palpating for steps or deformities. We're looking at the horizontal buttresses and the vertical buttresses, specifically kind of feeling around your four sutures where these typically propagate. And we'll get into that in just a second. So once we've sort of done our external examination, which sometimes is sort of blurred by the fact that a lot of times they develop fairly rapid edema, you know, a lot of times you're not palpating significant steps or deformities. When you see these acutely, which I have seen a few of, I mean, they have a dent in their face very frequently early on. I mean, there's no guessing as to whether or not something's going on. You can see a significant depression over the malar eminence. So anyway, external assessment and inspection. And then we get into the orbit, right? So you need to definitely do an ophthalmologic assessment. And you probably need to carry a Snellen diagram with you if you're taking primary call and doing these primary assessments, so that you can have sort of visual acuity assessed, look for extraocular motility and make sure that the globes are moving, globes are symmetrical. Your neurosensory and neuromotor assessment, obviously, we'll look at anatomy in just a second, but, you know, V2 coming out of the inferior orbital foramen is oftentimes compressed in these or frankly lacerated. Remember, your facial nerve is crossing over the zygomatic arch, you know, a couple centimeters anterior to the tragus. And so you have to think about that. From a right hook, you can certainly get a contusion type injury to the facial nerve. Or if it's a sharp trauma, you could get frank lacerations of that. And remember, this is what I always tell our fellow, and that is, if you didn't document a neurosensory or a neuromotor deficit during your primary assessment, and they have it during your post-operative visit, you cause the problem. So it's important that you document if they have a numb cheek, numb gums, numb teeth, or if a seven's not working at the forehead or the upper lid. You know, that needs to be documented in the primary survey. Look for pupillary light reflexes, just doing your standard swing test. Look for a Marcus Gunn pupil. I mean, we're just looking to do an ophthalmologic exam. I don't personally carry with me a tonometer, but, you know, you can carry a tonometer or an exophthalmometer. This is basically just looking at globe projection. A lot of times I'll just sort of fill the globes with my thumbs and you can sort of get a sense if one's tense or one's not. And then remember, so now we've done kind of our external buttress assessment. We've done our ocular examination. We're going to look at the TMJ now, not specifically from the standpoint of the joint itself, but do they have some kind of an entrapment, whether it's mechanical or muscular, right? So, and again, we'll look at the anatomy in a second, but the zygoma gets pushed in. You've got the coronoid process of the mandible in the vicinity. You've got the temporalis muscle running underneath the arch, inserting on the coronoid process. So do they have an impingement that's creating clinically significant restriction of mandibular range of motion? Remember with these fractures, I mean, these are usually, think about the zygoma itself. It's a very dense bone. It takes a lot of force to push this bone out of its position. And anything that hits you hard enough to displace the zygoma probably hit you hard enough to contuse the masseter muscle and the temporalis muscle. So sometimes, you know, contusions of these muscles and muscular bracing in the standpoint of opening can sort of fool you into thinking they may have, you know, an issue with a coronoid process or a temporalis impingement. So that's on your clinical exam, assess their maximum interincisal opening, and then zip into the mouth, right? So we're going to assess their occlusion. Your occlusal assessment, remember, when the zygoma gets pushed in, oftentimes the ZMC fracture will sort of propagate in a pseudo Lafort 2 pattern, right? So it'll kind of go at the zygomaticomaxillary buttress posterior laterally and kind of zip up through the inferior orbital frame. And then sometimes it'll propagate through the inferior fissure. And other times it'll sort of run up kind of the floor and into the medial wall a little bit. But you can get what I like to refer to as a warp-like injury to the maxilla, where the zygoma gets pushed in and it sort of pushes the dentition on the side of the fracture inferiorly slightly. It's sort of, you've driven a wedge into the midface that displaces the maxillary dentition slightly. So although it's not super clinically apparent, the patients might complain of premature contact of the teeth on the ipsilateral side of the fracture. So check the occlusion, check the range of motion, check for steps or deformities, and check the, you know, ocular examination. And then remember, you can get rents in the sinus floor. You can get rents in some of the vasculature coming in. So it's not uncommon to have hemorrhage into the sinus, which can result in ipsilateral epistaxis as well. So maybe a nasal speculum assessment. So that's sort of my thoughts on the ER primary survey, secondary survey, I guess, if we're getting called in. Any thoughts on the sort of initial assessment?
Yeah, that's good to assess all the, I mean, also ocular entrapment. I think you said that, doing the eye exam, having them move their eye back and forth, see what's going on there. Once you've done your exam, what type of imaging? There's probably already imaging there, but if you didn't have imaging, what would you get?
Yeah, perfect. Okay, before we jump into imaging, let me address two quick things. Number one, let's say that you have, so true emergencies where I might get called, where you might get called, or where, you know, a resident or somebody might get called. Number one, orbital compartment syndrome, right? So we have some vasculature that's running in the inferior fissure. We have the zygomatical frontal and temporal arteries that are kind of coursing through the zygoma. You can get bleeding. And if you don't have a significant orbital floor defect, there's no egress for that blood. So you can get a retrobulbar postseptal hemorrhage. And that postseptal hemorrhage can cause an increase in intraocular pressure. It can cause strangulation issues with the optic nerve. And so that might be a situation where we're needing to do urgent intervention. So if you have that situation going on, which is pretty rare, I probably see that once every other year or so, where I have to physically come in and do an intervention for that. Just a lateral canthotomy with an inferior limb cantholysis. A lot of times, you know, we talk about doing a lateral canthotomy. Remember, we're trying to create an egress for the fluid, or, you know, presumably blood, to get out of the retroseptal region. So a lot of times we'll talk about, you know, just taking an iris scissor, going into the lateral fornix of the eye and, you know, cutting down right onto the lateral sort of zygoma. Remember, you have to reorient the scissors after that horizontal cut so that you're cutting now down on the inferior limb of the lower canthus so that you're actually doing a cantholysis. So it's a lateral canthotomy with an inferior limb cantholysis. Now that lower eyelid is super baggy. You violated the septum and you can get a nice egress pathway for the blood to get out. That should take, like, you know, 20 seconds in terms of the maneuver. Take a little bit of lidocaine with epinephrine, stick it into the lateral canthal region, put a little bit of numbing in. It's a snip horizontally, reorient your scissors so you're cut onto that inferior limb of the lateral canthus and snip there, and then voila, you're done. What do you do with that when it's done? Well, you know, you decompress the hematoma, you're going to have, you know, blood coming out. You usually don't see a big rush of blood. It just relieves the pressure, because a lot of times that blood is a great big clot. And we're not going to go evacuate that blood. We're just trying to relieve pressure, which is being held or bound by that lower tarsus. So we just want to release that guy. And then, you know, when we go in and if we go in and do our repair of the ZMC, we can resuspend and repexy that lateral canthus. So that might be one true emergency. And the second would be, as you alluded to, entrapment. And entrapment comes in a few different shapes and sizes. Something to remember is just the entrapment happens when you have a minimal buckling of the orbital floor, typically, where it sort of blows down a little bit and comes back up and pinches the inferior rectus more often than not. And so you get this piece of muscle that's entrapped between the fracture, and you can frequently not really see the fracture on a CT scan. This is typically a green stick or sort of like a bowing fracture that you might see in a kid. So in an adult, pretty uncommon. If your call is on a 15-year-old kid that, you know, caught an elbow playing basketball, hit in the eye, and they're complaining of diplopia, double vision, you know, or complaining of, like, you know, severe nausea when they look up and down secondary to the oculotrigeminal slash cardiac reflex, that would be an indication that you might need surgery. So moving on to that, remember, entrapment is not a radiographic assessment. Entrapment is a clinical call. So if I had a dollar for every radiology read for a CT cella orbit that I get from a radiologist that says, cannot rule out likely entrapment, I'd be a millionaire. I mean, every single read is read like that by those guys, probably most likely CYA. But that is a clinical examination, a clinical assessment, and you just need to go in. These days, you know, with cell phones and whatnot, we're pretty lucky. I get a call from the ER doc and they say, I think this guy might have an entrapment. I say, send me over a video with him kind of firing all his fields of gaze. They're moving. They're not entrapped. It's very clear when they have an entrapment. And remember, you know, I work with an oculoplastics guy, a shout out to Brian Willoughby. He oftentimes talks about incarceration of the muscle as opposed to just sort of contents being entrapped. You can have some of Tenon's capsule, periorbital fat sort of stuck in the fracture that might impede movement a little bit, but you're not incarcerating muscle. The concern with the muscle incarceration is that that muscle is like being squozed in a vice grip, right? And as it does that, it compromises the vascular supply to the rectus. And in so doing, you get myofibrosis of the muscle and you get secondary strabismus issues. So it's really the incarceration of muscle in the fracture that is a concern, not so much entrapment of fat and tenon stuff. I mean, that might cause some subtle restriction, but it's really the incarceration of the muscle in the fracture. So if you have that, then, you know, off to the OR you go. And really, that's something that we try to get within 30 minutes to an hour. And with that, you know, it's a quick exploration. If you're going to go in there that acutely, I'm probably going to repair the ZMC, but we're going to go in and we're going to free that entrapped muscle out. And it's just like doing a Graves decompression. You create an orbital floor fracture. And then for me, I like to put a little plate over that little fracture defect that I created so that I make sure that I don't kind of retether. So moving on, those are our two kind of emergent situations. Imaging wise, you know, I think anybody that's doing facial trauma is using CT imaging at this point. I mean, they talk about submental vertex and Waters views and all these antiquated, you know, two-dimensional plane film x-rays. And it's just, we don't use those anymore at trauma centers. You can't diagnose orbital stuff particularly well with that. So maxillofacial CT, fine cuts. So you're going to go non-contrasted in this case, usually max face, and you want axial and coronal, and if feasible, sagittal or parasagittal oblique images. And that'll give you a nice, good three-dimensional look at exactly what you're trying to diagnose. And then if possible, most facilities now have the ability to do 3D reconstructions of those axial, coronal, and sagittal cuts. So in terms of imaging, that's sort of the way that I would go about kind of working this up.
So, okay. And then how do you make the decision to, I mean, you mentioned the urgent things that need treatment, but like if it's not urgent, how do you decide, yeah, let's go to surgery or, you know, non-surgical methods?
Yeah. So let's talk about timing. So this is going to come into the ER and, okay, let's say that there's a concern about, well, maybe this guy has a little bit of restriction upward gaze, which is what I typically get. Or, you know, the ER guy calls me. He's like, I'm not sure, dude. The radiologist said it looks like there's entrapment. And I'm doing my clinical exam and I'm just not positive. And so send me a video and I say, yeah, he's moving fine. Send him to my clinic for outpatient follow-up. Typically, in terms of timing on these mid-face fractures, you're talking kind of sort of like that 7 to 10 day range. Remember, you're going to get fairly substantial edema that happens in the initial 24 to 36 hours. So a lot of times, if you were to try to do this at 48 hours, 72 hours, their eyelids are swollen shut to the point that if you needed to get into the orbit, you really couldn't. Those dissection planes are so sort of just full of contused, you know, edematous fluid that you can't do that. So I usually say, send them to my office in 5 to 7 days, and then we'll sort of decide based on imaging and based on, you know, the clinical examination if this is a candidate for surgery. When we talk about surgical repair and do we fix this person or do we not, really think about what we're trying to correct. It's either a functional problem or an aesthetic problem. And that is sort of how ZMC fractures are boiled down. If we're correcting a functional issue, it's either a problem with opening the mouth, so we've got impingement on the cornoid or temporalis, or if it's a functional issue, we've got problems with the eye. So if you don't have any extra oculomotility issues and you don't have diplopia, we're not really probably fixing anything functional at that point, right? In which case it becomes an aesthetic repair. So now the zygoma is pushed out of position and we want to correct that malpositioning. And remember, the zygoma, when you're deciding on whether or not you repair it, you really want to look closely at what is the AP projection of the malar body, what's the transverse or lateral projection of the malar body, and then what's the vertical projection of the malar body, because they can be sort of displaced in or up or down or out, right? So, I mean, sometimes you see these EMC fractures, if it's a blow straight on and it's a high energy blow that involves like an NOE, a lot of times that'll blow your zygoma laterally, right? Which is like a devastating injury, but it widens the face. If it's a right hook or a fall down and I hit my cheek on the side of a table, that's going to push the zygoma in. And remember, you're not probably often going to appreciate the true nature of the orbital defect until you have fixed the zygoma. So a lot of times people talk about enophthalmos or hypoglobus in the context of an orbital floor component. But remember, when you get hit in the zygoma, if it gets pushed medially, one of two things is going to happen to the orbital floor. If it's a high energy blow, the orbital floor sometimes will blow down. So as the zygoma gets pushed in, it pushes the floor down and it sort of bows down. And as you repair the zygoma and pull it back out, now you've got a big hole in the floor that's going to need to be addressed. Other times, you get hit in the zygoma and the floor telescopes on itself. And in those cases, a lot of times you pull the zygoma out, you don't have to address the floor. So we're sort of look at the CT scan and the axial views. The axial views are going to do a nice job at showing you the AP deficit and the lateral deficit. So how far pushed back are they and how wide are they? And remember, if you think about where these fractures go, think about the zygoma and its sutures where it tends to break. You've got the zygomaticofrontal suture. We have the sphenozygomatic suture. You have the zygomaticotemporal suture, which is really the arch, the zygomatic process of the temporal bone and the zygoma. And then you have the zygomaticomaxillary suture, which is the inferior rim and the buttress. So that's where things are sort of going to break. And so when you start to look at these things, we're going to look at where are the fractures, how significantly displaced are we in the anterior and medial lateral. And then you can use your coronal views to assess the orbital floor. And you can use the coronal and then your sagittal views, obviously, to assess the orbital floor as well. So for me, I'm going to look and I'm going to sort of see a couple of different things. Let's say that you have somebody that's got a lot of subcutaneous adiposity, right? A chubby person. And it's a minimally displaced ZMC fracture. The orbital floor component's not that impressive. There's no functional deficit with opening. There's no ocular issues. That's going to be non-operative for me every day of the week. You might, on the flip side, have a real thin-skinned patient without a lot of sub-Q fat, and a moderately displaced fracture is going to really result in a significant malar depression that's cosmetically apparent. So you might say, well, like their ophthalmologic assessment's totally fine, but they're clearly pushed in at the malar buttress. Maybe they have a little vertical dystopia at the eye, et cetera. And in those cases, I'm probably going to decide whether we're going to do it. Remember, on your clinical exam, and one little pearl is, if a patient has compression at the inferior orbital nerve and they complain of paresthesia, if I have somebody that is their chief complaint, you know, my cheek, lateral nose, gums, and teeth are numb, that for me is not an indication for surgical repair. So, because you're going to overpromise and in many cases underdeliver. So, a lot of times I'll tell patients, look, that may or may not get better. So don't do the surgery if your biggest complaint is your cheek being numb, because it's just as likely to not come back as it is to come back. And I think if you set the expectation that, hey, we're going to go in here and when we pull this zygoma out, it's going to decompress this orbital nerve, you know, compression, and you're going to live happily ever after, I think you're setting yourself up for some problems. So make sure that, you know, the patients are well aware this might come back and it might not, but that's not why we're doing surgery. And then, you know, I just kind of talk through it with the patient. Here's the risks of surgery. Here's the risks of not doing surgery. If they're totally functional, but they have like a, you know, an aesthetic depression, maybe they don't want it. I've had plenty of guys in their 60s and 70s that, you know, they're pushed in a little bit and they don't care. They're like, I don't really care. I don't want a surgery, doc. And I've had, you know, other people that are sort of more self-aware in their 20s and 30s and 40s that say, look, I know it's not that bad, but I really want you to do your best to get this as close to where it was. So that's a decision where when it's strictly aesthetic, you know, the patient just needs to be informed of the risks and the benefits of the surgery. The functional stuff is much more easy to justify a complication with. So timing wise for me, I'm going to get them to the office five or six days out, and then we're going to discuss whether or not surgical repair is warranted. Pretty easy if they have diplopia or if they have a vertical deficit in the globe position, et cetera. A little bit less cut and dry if the eyeball's working well, if the eyeball's in a reasonable position, but they have, you know, a little depression at the malar buttress or a depression along the zygomatic arch. I mean, that sort of now is like, hey, this is a cosmetic surgical procedure at this point. And so, you know, let's talk about the risks associated with it.
Yeah. I mean, that was my follow-up question is like, what are the risks? What are the things that you run through with that patient who's really disgruntled with the cosmetic appearance?
Yeah. So I think a lot of that depends on which sutures you're going to try to repair. So when we classically talk about the modalities that are used to repair, I think historically, people would go in and they would expose all of these sutures, right? And so like a ZMC repair entailed a surgical approach suture, surgical approach to the inferior rim, surgical approach to the buttress through the mouth. And you would open up three different spots and then you'd, you know, put your reduction instrument on, Carol Girard screw, bone hook, whatever you want to use, get that bone out. And then you're going to stick a plate at the ZF and you're going to put two screws in that little plate and you're going to kind of rotate it in, then put a plate at the rim. And then you're going to come down and check out the buttress through the mouth and put a plate on there. I think some of that stuff is changing, truthfully, these days. We're moving towards less and less invasive approaches and treatments. And really, with the advent of intraoperative CT imaging, I think that's really been a game changer for us. So for us, like I did one last week where, you know, ZMC was displaced. If you look at what I'll always kind of try to assess is, was it a high or a low energy blow to the face? High energy blows, I mean, usually the zygoma is pushed back significantly. The floor is pretty broken up and we're going to plan on a couple of different approaches. Lower energy, which is like, you know, a trip and a fall and bang my cheek on the table. Sometimes you can get in with fairly minimal invasiveness. So in her case, for example, we're going to make a transoral approach, come into the, you know, intraorally to the zygomaticomaxillary buttress, maybe a little percutaneous stab for a Carol Girard screw, or you can use a keen type approach, which is just, you know, a transoral approach that lands your whatever instrument you want on the medial side of the zygoma. And we're going to elevate that piece of bone out. And then once I elevate it out, in her case, there was an audible click. Ah, that sounds nice. And then we spin her, right? Okay, let's spin her. CT intra-op, everything's anatomically aligned. Put a little digital pressure over the buttress. It's totally stable. And then your case is over. No need for plate and screw fixation. So in that case, I'm going to tell her, hey, look, you may just have a little oral incision and it's a relatively low risk thing, right? So in terms of risks, not that bad. If you look at the CT scan and there's significant displacement, significant comminution along the orbital floor, and, you know, displacement at three or four of those different fulcrum points, that's a different story. And so when I start to consent the patient, we're talking about coming through the lower eyelid, coming potentially through the upper eyelid, coming through the mouth. And in cases of severe deep projection, let's say, you know, the buttress is just pushed back, you know, 3-4 centimeters. Sometimes you need a coronal incision to appropriately position the zygomatic arch to get the buttress back to where it belongs. It's really hard to really get the AP projection right if you're trying to eyeball it and just kind of do it through the skin. So again, for us with the CT, as minimal invasion as possible. So risks of surgery really depend on your surgical approaches. So if you're coming through the upper eyelid, so let's back up a little bit and talk about quickly surgical approaches. So let's look at the ZF suture. We're going to try to get up to the zygomaticofrontal suture. We can do that via a couple of different approaches. Direct brow approach, which is just basically a cut down straight onto that ZF suture. That's right through the eyebrow. Probably not the best aesthetic approach, but it's very fast and not much to get in your way. The second approach to the ZF would be an upper lid blepharoplasty, so a supertarsal crease approach. Really, the only downside to that is if you dissect too deep, you can get on the backside of the septum. And I guess in theory, you could get into some of the levator muscles, Mueller's muscle, et cetera. That would be hard, but that's a risk there. So direct brow, upper eyelid approach, and then your lateral canthotomy with sort of an extended canthotomy, you can get up to the ZF as well. That tends to be my approach if I'm going to go towards the ZF suture and I'm going to be doing the rim, is I just make a very extended lateral canthotomy and then dissect, once I've done that, straight up the lateral zygoma. And that gives you access to both the inferior rim and to the ZF suture. So for the ZF, upper eyelid stuff, really pretty low in terms of morbidity. If you're going for the inferior rim, then you've got your three different lid approaches, right? So we've got to come through the lower eyelid somehow. Subciliary, subtarsal, transconjunctival. I mean, those are going to be your big players. Preseptal or postseptal transconj. And you know, there's pros and cons to all of those. But if you think about what our goals are with this surgery, most of the time it's aesthetic stuff, right? We want to try to repair an aesthetic deformity. If you botch the eyelid component of the surgery, you're going to leave them with a much more unaesthetic deformity than they may have had if you just left the buttress unoperated. So I don't take lightly going into the lower eyelid. I mean, you need to have justification for going down to the inferior rim. But if you're going to do that, for me, my major workhorse is a transconjunctival preseptal approach. You can go postseptal transconj, you can do subciliary, you can do subtarsal. Each one of those has its pros and cons. Each one of them has risks of entropion, ectropion, lid laxity. So, you know, things to think about. And then, so that's our rim and our orbital floor. And then, you know, obviously the zygomaticum maxillary buttress, we're just going to do, you know, gingival buccal sulcus, so depth of the maxillary vestibule on the ipsilateral side, really a pretty low stakes deal. If we're going to work on the arch, coronal is probably the way to go. I have done two or three cases with a colleague of mine, Mario Amola, who's an ENT facial plastics guy in town, where we've done endoscopic arch repair. It's always harder than we think it is. I use a end aural or a preauricular approach to the root of the zygomatic process. So just like I'm going into a TMJ, and then I sort of get that approach up and dissect in a subperiosteal plane along the root of the zygomatic process straight over the arch. And then I make another incision in the mouth and dissect from the mouth side back. And then using an endoscope, we connect the two pockets, and you can sort of string a plate from sort of the preauricular side to the oral side and use a little percutaneous stab to put a screw on the arch. It's kind of a flail fest, and I'm not probably ever super happy with it, although intermittently I sort of, you know, decide I want to try that and then I regret it. So I wouldn't recommend that to anybody, but that's sort of a non-coronal approach to an arch. So anyway, each one of those approaches has issues with motor and sensory nerves. And that's what I talk through with patient. Then of course, anytime you operate in and around the eyeball, there's risk of blindness and secondary muscular motility issues with the eyes. I think that's it in terms of approaches.
Is it pretty rare that you do address the arch and have to do a coronal, or how often do you have to do that?
So for me, pretty rarely, actually. It's amazing that as long as the periosteum around the arch is not violated, which it usually isn't, usually when you pull the zygoma forward and out, it's sort of interesting how that periosteal envelope just sort of seems to reposition the zygomatic arch. So more often than not, those buckling deformities on the arch component of the ZMC, as long as the periosteum is not super violated, it'll kick back out. And then remember, if you're in the mouth, you can certainly use a keen type approach. And, you know, you could also add to that a Gillies approach if you wanted to come down and kind of push the arch out if it were buckled in. So anyway, those would be my approaches. And then, you know, for me, typically what I'll do in kind of a lower energy hit is my first approach is going to be transoral. So we're going to come in through the mouth, low morbidity, and we're going to put a Carol Gerard screw or some kind of a, you know, an instrument kind of along the malar buttress. You can usually get that through a little stab incision over the cheek, put that in and pull it out, and then scan the patient. If it's not stable, we put a plate at the zygomatic maxillary buttress. If you scan the patient and it's not anatomically aligned, then typically the next thing that I'll do is jump up to the zygomatical frontal suture. So, and I'll usually do that if I'm going to go in isolation with just an upper eyelid blepharoplasty approach. So that's a quick little approach. Get up to the ZF suture. Again, use my, you know, transcutaneous instrument to kind of manipulate and put a plate at the zygomatical frontal and a plate at the infraorbital at the zygomatical maxillary. And remember, your major anatomic landmark, when you start getting into the terrain where it's like, well, it doesn't seem to be reducing well, that upper eyelid bleph approach is very easy to get at the lateral orbit. And you can look at the sphenozygomatic suture, which is your major landmark to verify your reduction. So you have to have a really bad hit to fracture the greater wing of the sphenoid, right? I mean, that is rock solid skull base. And so most of the time, that thing's not out of position. So barring significant comminution of the lateral orbital wall, most of the time, that's going to be our major landmark when we start wondering, how are we doing? Just through that upper eyelid bleph approach, dissect down the lateral wall and look at the sphenozygomatic suture. So if I've got a plate at the zygomaticum maxillary buttress and a VF buttress, then you can spin them again. You know, it's pretty rare that you're having to spin people two and three times intraoperatively. Most of the time, if the zygomaticum maxillary suture plate alone is not enough, then you get something to the ZF suture, and that's usually plenty, and you call it a day. Every now and again? No. I mean, every now and again, you'll spin them with, you know, the ZF plated and the zygomaticum maxillary suture plated, and the floor now is comminuted or it's open, and you feel like I'm probably going to need to address the floor defect, in which case now we can justify doing a lower eyelid approach. So that's kind of what I'm looking at if there's not a lot of comminution. I just go stepwise. Start simplest and move to most problematic in terms of incision. So start in the mouth, then go to the upper eyelid, then go to the lower eyelid if needed. If you look at the CT and it's like, this thing's blasted, it's comminuted, it's pushed way in, the floor is really in trouble, that changes personally my own approach. I'm going to do an extended lateral canthotomy with inferior limb canthalysis, preceptal approach down to the rim, and I'm going to expose everything. So inferior rim is going to get exposed, ZF suture is going to get exposed, again, through my lateral canthotomy, and I'm going to expose through the mouth. And then once I have all of those fractures exposed, then I'm going to start to plate. So usually I'll get a plate at the ZF. And remember, that can look totally anatomic, but a lot of times it's not. You've got some rotation deformity on the zygoma. So I usually plate the ZF. Then I'll zip down and look at the rim. If the rim's looking like it's in the right spot, I'll maybe put a plate on the rim, and then I'll check the buttress in the mouth and look to see. And if that is way off, then I'll say, okay, we're off somewhere. How does the sphenozygomatic suture look? We're really pretty rotated relative to that. So we're not putting in all the screws and all the plate holes. We're just putting a couple in to just sort of take this mobile piece of zygoma and stabilize it relative to, you know, the stable bones that it's connected to. While I'm fiddling with those, I'm never going to, like, for example, when I've done my preceptal transconjunctival approach to the lower rim, I will never carry that directly into the orbit during my initial approach. I'm going to leave all that orbital stuff totally intact. I want the periorbita intact because, again, sometimes if I jump in there and start dissecting the periorbita or the periosteum, right, off of the orbital floor, I've sort of diminish the chances that as I pull the zygoma out, it's going to auto reduce itself. So sometimes you create a defect that wouldn't have been there when you did the reduction. So I kind of get everything exposed. Don't go into the orbital floor until you've completely plated your buttresses. And then once those are plated, then go explore the floor if needed. So you do a CT scan once your buttresses are plated. If the floor has a big defect, go fix it. If the floor is back to where it belongs, voila, you're done. You don't need to do any intraorbital surgery.
Just a technical note, what style plates, size, and plates and screws are you using?
So, you know, they're different plating companies and they all come in different flavors. Usually the thickness is going to be 0.5, 0.7, and 1 millimeter thick. Think about how much tissue thickness you have over the plate that you're going to be placing. So at the zygomatical frontal suture and at the inferior rim, that's pretty thin tissue. You can palpate thick plates. So I might be inclined, depending on how displaced the fracture is, to use a 0.5 millimeter thick plate there and a 5 millimeter screw. Intraorally, at the zygomaticum maxillary buttress, I'll oftentimes just use a 1 millimeter thick plate or a 0.7 millimeter thick plate, like we would use in orthognathic surgery, an L plate, right? So you've got some stuff up on the zygoma and some stuff down on the maxilla. You can put a nice thick plate there and not think twice about, you know, having the patient be able to palpate it, et cetera.
Okay. And then what are some of the more common kind of long-term post-op issues you can see in some of these patients?
So at the end of the procedure, whether or not you've done anything with the floor, make sure you do a force duction test. I always tell our, you know, our fellow or whoever I'm working with, you need to grab the inferior rectus. You know, the force duction test, I know we see these pictures of these like, you know, 0.5 pickups that they use in oculoplastics, and they're grabbing, you know, the conjunctiva of the eye adjacent to the limbus and their lift. I mean, that's like, you have a hard time grabbing a chunk of tissue there without tearing the conj. So I look at the inferior limbus, go back 6 millimeters or so, take an Adson elevator and grab a chunk of inferior rectus, because that's sort of right where that inferior rectus inserts, wiggle up and down. Same thing medially, jump into the fornix, grab the medial rectus and move back and forth. So make sure you don't have a muscular entrapment after you repair. And remember, you're always going to put a corneal shield in there while you're working on the eye. So get the closure all squared away and good. When you think about post-operative issues, I think the first and most glaring is you've under-reduced the fracture, right? So we call that an OIF, or an open internal fixation minus the reduction component. And like, we've all had OIFs in our career where you look at the post-op CT scan and you say, man, I thought I was a lot more accurate than I am there. I personally am lucky enough to have intraoperative, you know, cone beam imaging technology where we can spin people. And I feel like we're doing a lot better job with these fractures now. Historically, you know, I do the ZMC repair and then I'd get a CT scan of the patient either in my office afterwards or in the hospital if I was concerned about something. And, you know, it's not uncommon that it's not great, but it's not probably bad enough to take back. And you just sort of accept suboptimal results because it's kind of a headache to go back to the OR. You got to tell the patient, hey, look, we didn't kind of get this where we thought we would get it, and we probably need to go back. Now with intraoperative CT imaging, it's like, I know before we extubate the patient that we're in the right spot. So complication number one, the OIF, the open reduction without internal fixation or at least reprojection. Complication number two, you can certainly, depending on your approach, you can really violate. Remember, the lower eyelid has three different lamella. If you get into that middle lamella, which is where the capsulopalpebral ligament structure is and all those lower lid retractors, if you botch the closure, you'll suture those lower eyelid retractors down to the arcus marginalis, the periosteum along the inferior rim. And that really causes major functional issues with the eye. So we think about botching the middle lamella up, and then secondary cicatricial contracture of the lower eyelid, right? You can certainly see if you don't get appropriate closure of the lower lid, or the retractors get closed in, or sometimes you just, you know, you don't close the periosteum and you get adhesion of the soft tissues to your plate along the rim. That's another deformity. We just submitted a paper where we've been using buccal fat pad transposition from the mouth up to the rim to try to minimize the cicatricial contracture. But, you know, lower and upper eyelid deformities secondary to our approaches are issues. And then again, if you over or underdo the orbital floor component, you can have hyper or hypoglobus, exophthalmos, proptosis, globe position issues that can secondarily cause diplopia and other, you know, functional deficits. So, you know, again, the unfortunate part of ZMC fractures is the complication profile is usually the same as the indications for surgery. We go in to fix them when we leave them with functional and aesthetic deficits. And that was sort of our goal, was to improve function and to improve aesthetics, you know? So that's why you just need to make sure that you're selective in your cases, because you don't want to go in there to fix a functional problem and leave them with an aesthetic deformity, or you go in with the goals of fixing an aesthetic deformity and you leave them with a functional problem.
Makes sense. Okay. Well, I mean, I think that's a great run through. Any other pearls about this? I think we've covered a lot.
I don't think so. I mean, I just basically gave a 35-minute oration, so sorry about that. That was my plan, is to not do that this go around, and here I've done it again. A little note, listen, if you get out a few months and the patient's still numb on the cheek, tincture of time, literature on using steroids, and there's, you know, other people that are maybe opposed to that, but just again, reassure the patient, but also let them know, I mean, look, again, this is not an indication for surgical repair. You might be numb when we're done with this. If you have diplopia post-surgically, or you've got ocular motility issues, most of the time we let those sit for about 6 months before we start sending them off to a strabismus surgeon. Those are, you know, guys that deal with muscle reinsertion along the globe, and they can, just like you can sort of balance a car with the alignment off, they can reposition the muscles on the globe and balance the globe. And in the interim, while we're waiting for that, look, if you get a patient, they've got some persistent double vision after you repair. And look, I've been there before where a patient didn't have double vision before, and then I go fix them and they have double vision for a little while afterwards. It's not a good feeling, but, you know, if you have an ophthalmologist that's a good buddy, they can put them into a prism glass while they're kind of hanging out. The patient usually does really well with the prism glasses. And those guys are not inclined to go in and operate usually before 6 months, because most of the time you'll get adaptation. So don't be real keen on going in and starting to fiddle around. I always recommend have them get an ophthalmologic examination before you do your repair. You never know what's going, unless you're like super savvy at doing a dilated fundoscopic examination. just have them see an ophthalmologist, look back at the retina, make sure there's no retinal detachment, make sure there's no other issue that way. And then one other note, if in the context of the trauma, you see fat herniating out of the orbital septum. So let's say there's a septal violation on your primary or secondary survey. So you've got, fat pooching out of the inferior fornix through the conge. You have to think about a globe rupture in those cases. And so, make sure that the CT scan, talk to the radiologist, do you see any globe rupture? And if there's concerns, you feel like they've got like a soft eye, make sure you have opto consulted and make sure they take a look at that. And then last pearl is, I have had two patients in 13 years, not a ton, but that had ZMC fractures and they were blind in the contralateral eye. For me, that's a non-op. So, they're obviously not going to have binocular diplopia if they're blind in one of their eyes. So, and they're probably not going to, develop visual acuity deficits. So really barring like true entrapment, I'm not going to go in and fiddle around on a ZMC if a patient's blind in the contralateral eye. I think the stakes are a little bit too high. So in that case, if there's just a really horrendous deformity and you're real concerned, you probably want to saddle up with an oculoplastic surgeon that sort of lives and dies in the orbit and have them get involved in the case so that you don't, God forbid, render somebody blind in their functional eye. So that would almost be, for me, a contraindication to going back in and fixing is if you're blind in the other side. I think that's probably it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you for running through all that. If there are, listeners who have further questions, if you're cool, I can put your email in the show notes and have them reach out to you.
Yeah, let me give a plug. So we do, AO North America does a course. It's going to be going on in Random, Massachusetts in April here. But I really think it's one of the best courses for orbital kind of fractures and mastery. So I don't know what the census is this year. It may be full, but if you want to really get in, this is an anatomic specimen study where we fracture cadaver ZMCs and orbits and frontal sinuses and NOEs. There's little lectures. Then you go down to the lab. We have intraoperative CT imaging. We have the ability to use brain lab. We have patient-specific implants. And you can really get yourself up to tune on the state of the art in fracture repair. So, it's awesome to go in. You're working on cadavers. You're doing the dissections just like you would in a human and getting comfortable with those. So whether it's a younger resident that you're kind of starting to become a higher level guy or gal and you want a little bit more comfort in that, or you're a practitioner that's been out of the loop a little bit and you just kind of want to get back into trauma, you're starting to take call for your panel. It's a fantastic course with, world-class faculty, guys like Michael Bradstrong, Mark Engelstad, Travis Tollefson, these guys that are just giants in their respective fields. So major plug for that. So if people are wanting a little bit more exposure, check out the AO Advanced Orbit Midface course. It's fantastic.
Terrific. Well, we could put a link to that too in the show notes. And then also you were mentioning you're starting up a fellowship. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. How about a shameless plug? So we have, through our group here in Denver, we've run a trauma fellowship. Typically, right now, our trauma fellow is an oculoplastics trainee. Historically, that fellowship has included exposure to oral and maxillofacial surgery, oculoplastic surgery, ENT facial plastics, general plastics, and oncology. It's like really a dream fellowship. And we finally kind of decided that in 2025, July, so like a year from this summer, we're going to bring on our first OMFS person. The fellowship is effectively going to be fairly heavy in orthognathic surgery. That'll be kind of run out of my practice. We do, I would guess you'll probably do anywhere from 4 to 6 double jaws a week for the year. It ebbs and flows obviously seasonally, but you'll have a lot of exposure to orthognathic surgery. And then trauma surgery, you'll be exposed to, my service line, ENT facial plastics and oculoplastics. So you're doing trauma with the three different specialties, general plastics on occasion as well. So you're doing trauma with the guys and gals that do it from every specialty. It's a true multidisciplinary approach to trauma. And then there's a component that's aesthetic too. So you would spend 1 day a week kind of doing ENT facial plastics, so rhinoplasty, facelift, et cetera. And then that 1 day a week that you're with those guys, it would be either with the ENT facial plastics guy, the oculoplastics guy, or the head and neck oncology guys. And so there's a fantastic team down at University of Colorado Highland Ranch, Chris Oliver and his group, John Campana. They're phenomenal surgeons that can navigate neck dissections and free fibula flaps. And these cases that as residents we'd watch, I remember doing anesthesia for these cases and it was like a 20-hour case. These guys are going in banging out a bilateral neck and a mandibulectomy and a free fibula, and they're done at, you know, 1:30 in the afternoon and in the mountain skiing, you know, doing what we all do this for. So if you have listeners that are interested in, you know, I like to call it like the super chief year. I mean, it's just a year where you're going to bang out a lot of stuff and get very comfortable doing surgery in a true multidisciplinary fashion, where you're going to have exposure to a lot of different service lines. If you put my email in the podcast show notes, you know, reach out to me, send me a CV. You know, I've said it once and I'll say it before: don't apply if you're not a cutter. We don't want a project. We like to train people that are whatever. Come one and come all. We'd love to help people to grow. And, you know, I think all of us that do this, for me, for trauma in our group, we don't operate alone. So it's very rare that I do a ZMC by myself. I'm in there with an oculoplastic surgeon almost always. If I'm doing complex pan facial, sometimes there's three private guys. There might be me, an ENT facial plastics guy, an oculoplastics guy. And I feel like because of that, patients really are the benefactors of good care. You know, there's no egos that get in the way that say, I'm not going to consult another service line. This is just three, four, five buddies that love being in the OR together that come from different specialties. And I think all of us kind of had that itch to be in academics, but we all are really comfortable in our private sectors. So it was like, you know, a couple of years ago, we thought, why don't we start running a fellow through? And, you know, it's historically been ENT or oculoplastics. And we decided, you know what, my orthognathic side is busy enough that I think we could probably really have that be the crux or the major focus is orthognathic TMJ replacement stuff, and then supplement it with trauma, cosmetics, and oncology. So I don't, you know, you're not going to come out of the fellowship with a certificate in facial plastics and head and neck cancer. But, you know, gosh, if you finished your chief year, you came out, you spent a year, you're going to be for your oral boards and whatnot. I mean, you'd be going to tumor board, you'd be doing facial plastics, you'd be super comfortable walking through a neck dissection, a rhinoplasty, a facelift, upper lid, blefs, brows, all the good stuff is right there. So seamless plug, if you're interested, hit me up, send me a CV. We're going to be interviewing kind of late summer, early fall, and we're excited to be able to bring our first OMS fellow into the fold, where we've been kind of training other specialties for last. So thanks for the opportunity to shamelessly plug that.
No, that's a tremendous opportunity. I'm glad you're setting that up and we're able to give it a little exposure here. Aaron, thank you so much for taking the time today. This has been awesome for me and I'm sure listeners. I'll put all of this contact info and links in our show notes, and let's do it again sometime.
Would love to. Thanks for humoring me and listening to me. And it's always a pleasure and an honor to be with you.
I appreciate it. You're the man. All right. Have a good night. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, man.
Goodbye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.